Thank you, Vice Chancellor, for those kind words, and I must confess, I think I'm still struggling to find out what an astrophysicist does. Okay, so for the last couple of decades, I have been trying to understand what it is, how it is that galaxies have evolved since the beginning of the universe until today. So in order to try and understand how galaxies have evolved, we need to understand how the stars within them have changed over time. And to study that, we need to look at very distant galaxies. Galaxies are a long, long way away. And when we look at those galaxies, we find that they're often enshrouded in dust. And that dust makes them difficult to see. That dust is like a smoke blocking out the signal from these distant galaxies. So I've entitled my talk today, Smoke Signals from the Distant Universe. So before I move on, I need to thank lots of people. Now, as Vice Chancellor said, these astrophysics projects are very, very big collaborations. It would be impossible to list all the people who've been involved in a lot of these projects. Many of them have hundreds, or certainly tens of people. So I've listed the projects that I've been involved with. And I'd just like to highlight one here, which is SPIRE, which is an instrument on Herschel, which I'll be talking about a lot today. And Matt Griffin, who was the PI of this instrument, is here today. But of course, locally, a lot of the work that's been done at Sussex is done by research fellows and research students, and I've listed their names here. And you'll have seen many of the research students outside today running the camera, and they've been helping set up all the experiments, so big thanks to them. And I'd also like particularly to thank Michael Rowan Robinson, my PhD supervisor, who started me off on this track and has been a great supporter throughout. And finally, I'd like to thank my family, Diana, Luke, Laura, and Kit, for all their suffering of me working late, going abroad, and not spending as much time with them as I should. So thanks to all of them. And of course, thank you to all of you for coming, and I hope you'll enjoy this. Okay, so by the end of the lecture today, I hope that you'll have had some inclination of why we want to study the evolution of galaxies and the stars within them over the age of the universe. I'll try and convince you that that's an interesting thing to do. And in particular, I'm going to try and indicate how we study star formation. So we've got some things here which will hopefully help us understand how we do that. And then I'll give you some pictures of what sorts of things we do see when we're studying this star formation. And then at the end, I'm going to give you some highlights from the project that I'm leading, which are trying to answer the question, when did star formation happen and where did it happen? Okay, I appreciate that many of you are not astronomers, so I'm going to have to give you a very quick crash course in astronomy. I'll just have to try and see how far we get. Okay, so we'll start with the most obvious, the Sun. You'll all be familiar with, and of course, I'm sure most of you know that the Sun is a star. It's a massive object. It's about 300,000 times the mass of the Earth. Now, when we look at star formation, we're often interested in massive stars, and the reason for that is massive stars produce a lot of light. So massive stars are the key sort of signature of star formation. They're the most obvious thing that you see when you see star formation. And when I say massive stars, I mean things that are tens or hundreds of times the mass of our own Sun. So these are very, very big things, and they're very bright. Now, stars don't burn fuel like coal or wood. The way they're fueled is through nuclear fusion. They burn hydrogen, the lightest of the elements, and they burn that up through heavier elements through this nuclear fusion. So that's something that's important to know. Okay, and then introducing the cast further, we're interested in galaxies. And galaxies are huge collections of stars, many billions of stars. Our own galaxy, the Milky Way, has 300 billion stars within it. Now, the Milky Way has a star formation rate of about one sun every year. So that doesn't sound very much, but of course, if you remember that the universe is 13.7 billion years, then a few million years here or there is nothing. So within that time, you can form many, many stars. But some of the objects that I'm interested in are things we tend to call starburst galaxies, and these are things which are somewhat larger than our own Milky Way, but they have star formation rates that are 10 or 100 or even perhaps 1,000 times more than our own Milky Way. And then putting that in context itself, in the observable universe, there are about 10 billion galaxies. Okay? So this is all quite big scale stuff, but a lot of the things that we're interested in are quite small. One of the things that we're interested in is gas, and it's important to realise that most of the atoms in the universe are hydrogen. Okay, now I said that we were talking about smoke signals from the early universe, and when I'm talking about smoke, I'm talking about dust, which is it's a particle, amorphous grains that are very similar to something like cigarette smoke. Okay, so when I talk about dust, that you sort of picture in your mind some cigarette smoke or something like that. So it's complex molecules aggregated into little particles. Okay, so that's some background into the sort of astronomy and physics that we'll need as we go through this. The other thing that we need to understand is why we look at the distant universe. Okay, so there's this fortunate fact, which is that the speed of light is finite, and what that means is that it takes a certain amount of time for the light to reach us from objects. So it takes 1.255 seconds for the light to get from the Earth to the Moon. It takes 8 minutes for the light to come the 150 million kilometers from the Sun to the Earth. So those are quite short times, but as you move to astrophysical objects, these times become longer and longer. So the time to the nearest star is 4 years. The nearest galaxy to us, Andromeda, is 250 million light years away, so that means it takes 250 million years for the light to reach us from Andromeda. So that means if there was an astronomer today in Andromeda looking at the Earth, they wouldn't see us around today, they would see the dinosaurs walking around on the Earth. And so we exploit that feature to look back in time. So when we look at distant galaxies, and the galaxies that I'll focus on at the end in our Herschel surveys, we are seeing them 8 to 12 billion years ago. So we're seeing these galaxies as they used to be in the very, very early stages of the universe. Okay, so that's the kind of crash course in astronomy. I hope I've still got you all with me. What I want to explore now is why we want to go and study the galaxy evolution and the star formation history of the universe. So firstly, I think this is one of the fundamental origin questions, the sort of questions that we've been asking as humanity for thousands of years. You know, how did we come to be here? How did the universe come to be here? We didn't always ask the questions like this, but how was the universe formed? How were the galaxies formed? How were the stars formed? The planets formed? How did life emerge? And so on. Okay, so the formation of galaxies and stars is a crucial part of that sequence. And I think in many ways that is motivation enough. But I think there's a bit more of a practical origin, practical rationale for studying the history of star formation. And that is because the star formation history is directly linked to the origin of elements. So if we start just after the Big Bang, the universe is mostly made of hydrogen, a little bit of helium, but mostly hydrogen. And if nothing else happened, the universe today would be a very, very boring place. But what happens in a star is that the hydrogen burns to helium, the helium burns up to heavier elements and so on. Okay? And these massive stars that I emphasized, the massive stars will produce elements within them through this nuclear fusion burning all the way up to iron. So you may remember from your school days, if you're not readily familiar with it, the periodic table here. So we start off, hydrogen is the lightest element over here. And as the star burns, it produces all of these more complicated, more massive chemicals right up to iron here. So all the things that we need for life, like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, all of these are produced in stars. And then, when these massive stars go supernova, two things happen. One thing is they put all those elements that they've created into the medium around them, and they also, in the explosion itself, produce many more of the material. So all the chemicals around us were produced by essentially by those massive stars. But these massive stars are very luminous, they're very bright, they're very active, and because of this, they don't last very long. They use up their fuel very quickly. So in a mere few million years, they die. When they die, they have the supernova, they explode, they put the chemicals back into the environment. But what that means is that since they live a very short period of time, they must have the massive stars must have been born within the last few million years. So that means that the only time you will see massive stars is when there has been some recent star formation. Otherwise, they will have already been dead and gone. So that means that active star formation is linked with the massive stars, is linked with the production of metals. Okay, so how do we study this star formation? Well, here's a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is a star formation region in our own galaxy. It's a close-up. We're looking in detail at a region where star formation is going on. And I think the most striking thing about this is how few stars there are there. I mean, you can see half a dozen kind of bright stars, but really that's it. The dominant feature in this is this wispy, cloudy material here. And this is the dust. So this dust is blocking out the light from all of the stars behind. There's many, many stars being formed in this region, but the light from them is being blocked out by this dust. Another thing you can see here is this edge here, and this sort of light illuminated here. There are some stars off the picture here which are catching the edge of this dust and producing these very nice pictures. You don't have to look at a detailed picture with the Hubble Space Telescope to appreciate this, though. If you go to, out in the South Downs or a really nice site where there's, you're not affected too much by light pollution, then you can see the Milky Way. Okay, and so this is a band of light across the sky, and this band is the disk of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. So you can see all these stars, but the other thing that you'll notice is these dark regions here. And these dark regions, you might naively think, are the absence of stars, but in fact, these are regions of dust where the dust has blocked out the light from the stars behind. And in fact, the few stars that you see here are probably stars that are in front of the dust, and rather than ones that are behind. So this dust has quite a large impact, even on a large scale in our own galaxy. If we move to a more distant galaxy, we can see an even more dramatic effect. This galaxy here is known as the Black Eye Galaxy, for reasons that you can see. And what you can see is this would be a classic spiral galaxy, with all the spiral arms and so on. But what you see is almost half of this object has been obscured by dust. So half of the light has been just wiped out. We can't see it. So if star formation regions have all this dust, and this dust is blocking out the light, how are we going to study them? Okay, so fortunately, the light that we see in our eyes isn't the only way of seeing. Okay. So in the 1800s, William Herschel discovered that that light extended beyond the region that you can see with your eyes, beyond the visible. And he did this with a few thermometers, and he stuck a thermometer in a spectrum, and we've got a spectrum up here to give you for reference. So if you put a thermometer in that, obviously it would warm up because of the light. If you put what Herschel did was he put a thermometer just slightly to the red end of just outside where you can see light, and he found that the temperature of the thermometer still rose. And so he deduced that there must be light beyond the red that you can't see. Okay, so now I'm going to try and do some demonstrations to show how this works. So we need to switch on to the camera. Okay, so this light, which is here, is being picked up by this camera. And I think you can see that this light, that this is not on, okay? The light is not on. But if you look here, you can see a very faint glow, okay? So what we've done is we've actually switched the light on, but at a very, very low level, okay? So it's just enough to just heat up the element in there, a very small amount, so that it's at a relatively low temperature. And because it's at a low temperature, it's not emitting ordinary light, it's emitting infrared light. And this camera is just sensitive enough to pick up that infrared light. Now, if you don't believe me, if you think I'm doing some sort of trick, you can try this at home. Okay, if you take a remote control and a phone camera or something like that, you can point the remote control, and you can't see anything in a remote control, right? There's nothing there. Okay, but if you point that at your mobile phone camera, then you should be able to see it lighting up just as we can here. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. So there is light beyond the infrared, but what I've emphasised is that that's quite cold. Now, if we turn up the temperature of that element. I wonder if any of you can guess what will happen. Okay. And so you see it's now glowing red. Now, we could have done this with a poker or something, but all manner of things could have gone wrong. Now, as we turn up the voltage, we're turning up the temperature, okay, and it gets hotter and hotter. The wire's getting hotter and hotter, and you can see that the colour has changed. We've gone from red through to white or to yellow, okay? And that's what happens, right, is as you turn up the temperature, things go from red to more blue colours, yellow and then blue. Okay, right, so that's illustrating that. I think we can switch that off now. And now, this is where you might want to check out where the fire exits are. And also, check under your seats for life vests, I think. Okay, right. So what we're going to do here is simulate a galaxy undergoing star formation in a fish tank. Okay, right. Here we go. We're just starting off the star formation. Oh, right. Nope. There you go. No problem. We'll try that again. I've got five matches here, so should be all right. Let's try that. Okay. Right. So there we go. There's our star formation happening, and you can see there's a lot of dust being produced in that. And in a minute, I think it's leaking a bit. All right, we better get on with this one quickly. Okay, so have we got the infrared camera on? Okay, so good. So I think you'll agree that you can't see anything through there. Okay, but now, if we take the infrared camera, okay, now let's see, I have to focus this. Okay. So there we go, through that. I think we can see that we've got something going on. Oh, there we go. There we go. So look, you can see there's a little spiral galaxy just forming. Right there. Okay. Right. Okay. Thanks, Pete. You better put that outside quickly. Okay. So and now I'm just gonna wrap that off just in case that hadn't worked. So here you can see two cups, and one of them is hot, and one of them is cold. Okay. So you can see you can use the light to tell you the temperature of the object. Sorry about the smoke. Right. Okay, I think I'm done with demonstrations now. Okay, so we'll flick back to. Oh, and I should say that if you go outside, we'll have the infrared cameras. If you want to get your photo taken, we're going to try and take people's photos and give you a photo of yourself through the infrared camera. Okay. Now, I'm going to get back. Okay, so I'm going to now find my laser pointer. Right, turn that off, didn't I? Okay, so here we go. The summary of those demonstrations are there is light that we cannot see, okay? So you saw infrared light that you couldn't see with your eyes. Everything emits light, and that light depends on its temperature. So the light bulb that you saw was glowing because it was hot. And colder objects emit redder light. Okay, so as we turned up the temperature, we saw things going whiter and bluer. And we've seen that dust blocks out optical invisible light. And we've also seen that infrared can see through the dust. So what this means for astronomy is that these massive stars that I talked about that are important for producing these elements, they're very bright, they're very hot, and so they're very blue. The sun, on the other hand, is colder and redder. And also, the other thing that we know, although I haven't demonstrated this, is that far infrared telescopes will be able to see very, very cold emission. So they will actually be able to see the emission from the dust itself. So that dust was getting warm in there, but not very warm, so it wasn't warm enough for us to see it. But with a far infrared telescope, more longer wavelengths than this, you'd actually be able to see the dust itself. Okay. So when I was an undergraduate, I was trying to decide whether I wanted to do particle physics or astrophysics. And it was a difficult decision because they're both really kind of fun. You know, one is the science of the very, very small and one's the science of the very, very big. And I was completely torn. And then I started thinking, well, if I do particle physics, I go to CERN, which is in Geneva, which would be great for about a year. And then I thought, now, if I do astronomy, I could go to the Canary Islands, Hawaii, Australia, Chile. And at that point, I knew what I was going to do. But it was very fortunate that I did make that decision, because just before I started doing a PhD, the infrared astronomical satellite had been launched. And that made this beautiful map of the sky here. So this is an infrared map of the sky, and you can see the galactic plane running across the middle here. But in addition to the galaxy, our own galaxy, the Milky Way, this detected thousands of nearby star-forming galaxies. And that was what I spent my PhD doing, was studying those galaxies. But since then, there have been many missions that have gone up. Oops, sorry, too many presses. Many missions that have gone up to study the infrared sky. The European Space Agency mission ISO here, Japanese mission Akari here, American mission COBE, and the NASA mission Spitzer. So I've been involved in many of those, but I'm going to focus here on Herschel, the Herschel mission, which is the most recent. So the raison d'etre of Herschel was exploring the formation of galaxies and stars. So the topic that I've been talking about was really the reason that this mission was put together. Okay, so here is Herschel, and there's a model of it over here. Matt Griffin, as I say, the PI of one of the instruments on it is here, and he can tell you a lot more about the instrument and the mission than I can. I'll just say a couple of things, which is here's the mirror. You can see Herschel here waiting in a laboratory in the Netherlands just before it was shipped off to be launched. Here's the mirror, and probably the most important feature of Herschel is the mirror. This is a 3.5 meter diameter mirror, and if you want to know what that's like, that's this big. Okay, so this is the diameter of Herschel. That's quite big. That is the biggest telescope in space. Okay, Hubble Space Telescope, for example, is 2.5 meters in diameter. And to contrast that, the previous missions had mirrors that were about that big. Okay, so it's a real step change. And that size means that we can study more and more distant objects and study the nearby objects in more and more detail. Okay, so Herschel was set for launch in 2009, and I was lucky enough to go to the European Mission Control in Darmstadt, and there was about 200 people in a big hall watching the launch. And I'm thinking there's probably about 200 people in here. So I just want you to sort of picture yourself in a big hall like this, watching on a video screen the potential launch of a mission that you've been working on, in some cases for 10 years, in some cases perhaps even for longer. Okay, so the thing that you've been working very hard on is sitting just about here on top of this big rocket. Okay, now at this point, anything could happen. Okay, the launch could be delayed for a month, for a year. You could have postdocs at home kind of waiting to exploit this data, and nothing will come back to them. The whole thing could blow up. Who knows? So picture yourself in that position, watching this, and let's see what happens. Oh, the first bit is in French. I can translate that if anyone needs it.
Arrivage des heures de décollage. project, blue.
Okay, and now we switch to an animation. So this was a fabulous, completely successful, faultless launch. It was launched exactly on time, and the mission itself has been a fabulous success. Every instrument has worked impeccably. And as I say, I've been involved with many of these missions, and there is just coming out the fairing there, but that's an animation. Okay, so it's all been incredibly successful. Okay. Until now, and the slide won't advance. There we go. Okay, so what do we see with these missions? Well, firstly, here is a picture of the Orion constellation, which you could imagine with your naked eye. So here you've got Orion's belt. This is the Orion Nebula that you might be able to see with binoculars or something. You've got Betelgeuse up here. So that's a picture that you can you could be familiar with. On the right is the picture of exactly the same bit of sky, but taken by the infrared astronomical satellite IRAS over here. And the contrast is staggering. Okay, so this is a completely different view of the sky. So here you see bright regions here where there's nothing here. So what we're seeing here is the dust that was blocking out the optical light, emitting glowing, and being detected by the IRAS mission. And now we can look in more detail at a particular region in our own galaxy. This is the Rosette Nebula. This is an optical image from a ground-based telescope. And you see here a cluster of stars in the middle and then this diffuse nebula of dust around. And now we can overlay the Herschel picture of the same region of sky. Okay, so I'm going to flick back and forth between these two to illustrate some points, which is that this dark region here becomes filled in when you get the Herschel picture. Okay, so again, completely different view of the star formation region. So here's a zoom in on the Rosette Nebula. What you can see here is little clumps here. These are protostars, stars that are just being born now. Here you can see some dust that's been heated up by the embedded stars, glowing very brightly. And here, as you could before, you kind of see the edge of the dust heated up by the stars that are off the screen. And so this dust is slightly bluer, slightly hotter than this colder dust over here. So you're getting a fantastic view of star formation in our own galaxy. And if we move again to our friend Andromeda, so remember this is 250 million light years away, so they're looking at our dinosaurs at the moment. And here we see a blue in the optical, so this is an ordinary telescope, looking at Andromeda, you can see two things, really. You can see a disk of blue stars, and you can see a red, what we would call a bulge, in the middle. So remember, the blue stars are the hot, massive stars. So these are the ones that you only see when you've had recent star formation. So this disk is actively forming stars. This red bit in the middle, on the other hand, you can't see any blue stars, so that means there hasn't been much star formation. So in the middle, there's not much star formation going on. And now, if we look at the Herschel image over here, that confirms that picture. So in the middle, you see nothing. There's no star formation going on in the middle. But within the disk, you can see a lot of activity, a lot of star formation going on, and you can see that follows the spiral arms of Andromeda. So this is giving us a fantastic picture of star formation in nearby galaxies. But now we can look at a more active star-bursting galaxy. This is a famous galaxy, M82, which is our nearest starburst galaxy. And this is a composite from a number of different telescopes, including Spitzer, the NASA mission. And what you see again is a blue disk, which is where star formation is going on. This is a heavily obscured object, so a lot of the light is coming out at infrared. This picture highlights the fact that the massive stars turning into supernova are driving out material from this galaxy in these what we call galactic superwinds. So a very impressive example of a star-bursting galaxy. Okay, so my stuff is focusing more on the distant universe. And so in 1997, the Hubble Space Telescope undertook an experiment to make the deepest possible map of the optical sky. And this is an animation from them zooming in into this region that they studied incredibly well. You saw that we started off from the plough. And so they produced this fantastic map of the very, very distant universe. These galaxies are very, very faint, which means they're a long, long way away, which means that we're seeing them as they used to be a long, long time ago. And so this gave us a very valuable insight into the early universe. But this was just taken at optical wavelengths, so it didn't tell us about the star formation that was going on in great detail. So what we did is we went and observed that same patch of the sky with an instrument called SCUBA, which observes at long wavelengths. And we've got, as we've seen with the other experiments, we've got a very different picture. Okay, this is a completely different view of the sky. And here we detected about 5 galaxies, which compares with the thousands that you see in this very deep Hubble Space Telescope image. But the brightest thing that we saw here, this blob here, is actually completely invisible in this, which, remember, was the deepest possible image of the sky. Okay? So it's telling you something completely different. And after many years of struggling to do anything with this object, because, of course, we couldn't see it, right? It was very hard to study. We did, you know, it was eventually confirmed that this was a galaxy some 10 billion years ago that was forming stars at a prestigious rate, but it was just not observable in the Hubble Space Telescope, the deepest Hubble Space Telescope image at the time. Okay, so I'm now going to move finally on to the project that I've been leading, which is HERMES, the Herschel Multi-Tiered Extragalactic Survey. So this is a big multinational team with about 30 different institutes, well over 100 people working on it. And those people were built out of the SPIRE team. So the one of the instruments, as I said on here, was SPIRE, PI Matt Griffin. And some fraction of that team got together and produced a plan to use the time on Herschel to carry out this census, if you like, of the distant universe. And we were fortunate to be able to use a really significant amount of time on the Herschel Observatory. So we used about 5% of the entire mission. It was the largest project that Herschel undertook. And what we produced were some maps of the distant sky, and we discovered many, many galaxies. This was our first picture. So here you can see lots of little dots, okay? Now it may look a little bit, kind of funny, but every single one of those dots is a galaxy. Okay? Every single one of them, okay, and they're just running into each other. There's so many of them; they're just all over the place. Okay, there's thousands and thousands of them in here. Okay, now in contrast, this is the same bit of sky that I just showed you that in 1998 we observed. This is to scale. Okay, here we saw 5 objects, and here we are now seeing thousands. So this was a real step change. Okay, and now, in fact, I can sort of give you some numbers to indicate the kind of step change. So in 1991, I was doing my PhD, and we discovered one galaxy that was at the same kind of distance as these. One galaxy has a very exciting name of F10214, I remember us discovering that. I was with a postdoc, Tom Broadhurst. I was a PhD student. And he sat down and he had a spectrum of a galaxy that was, you know, not the one that we were interested in. And we had the spectrum of the galaxy that we'd just found, right? And we couldn't make sense of this, okay? We've been trying to understand this galaxy for ages and ages. And what we needed to do was we needed to find out where these lines would match up. And I was a naive PhD student, right? So I didn't really know. So I just said, well, what about if it was like that? And it was sort of like, it was like a really, you know, it couldn't possibly be that, because that would mean it was a really, really distant galaxy. But it turned out that that was the right answer. And so this was a very, very distant galaxy, and we discovered it. And in fact, that was so remarkable that that galaxy made it into the Guinness Book of Records. And so it was in the Guinness Book of Records for at least a year. I don't know. Anyway. Okay, so in 1991, there was one. In 1998, we had 5 of them. Okay, in 2009, I was just about to go and present. So Herschel was launched in 2009. I was just about to go to a meeting and present these results for the first time, the big Herschel meeting. We weren't allowed to show these results to anyone. Okay, we had to be completely secret about it. I happened to be at a meeting in Austria just before, And we were in the bar with various people, and we kind of went, well, how many galaxies do we know about? And we totted them up, and we reckoned that in 2009, we knew of about 2,000 of these sorts of galaxies. And then a few days later, I stand up in this Madrid meeting and show this and say, well, now we've got 20,000. So it was just a huge change. And probably by now, 2012, this is probably a conservative estimate, actually. I'm guessing that there's probably about 200,000 that we know about. Okay, and this was so exciting. This was so exciting. In fact, it was so exciting that the Argus picked it up. And what I particularly like about this is that they put us right next to the astrology column. So we need to address this question. When did this star formation occur? So I'm going back to my PhD. Sorry to keep harking back to my PhD. It's just quite a nice sort of reference point of kind of where we were a long time ago to where we are now. But anyway, in my PhD, I did a plot in a paper. This paper was about kind of something else. It doesn't really matter. But this plot, unfortunately, I didn't label it Star Formation History of the Universe. Had I done that, it would have got a lot more citations, I think. Anyway, I did this plot, which showed these graphs, which is basically the Star Formation History of the Universe, as we thought of it then. So going from here to day zero out to the beginning of the universe back here, 13.7 billion years. And so I had these lines, which showed what we kind of thought maybe the universe was doing. But that was a bit of an extrapolation because actually the amount of data we had was here. Okay, so we were sort of going, well, we've seen this, and what we reckon is that it's like this. Okay, but now we've been working on this for decades, and the latest result that we're just about to publish is that this is now our current view of what the star formation history of the universe is. So here is today, okay, and here's back at the beginning of the universe, and what we think is that the star formation history in the universe has been rising up, and it's some 50 times more star formation in the distant universe at about 7 or 8 billion years. It's then relatively flat, and then arguably, although it's very hard to tell really what's going on here, it's arguably starting to decline. Okay, so we finally have reached this point where we have some understanding of how much star formation is happening in the universe and when it was happening. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to talk about is where is this star formation occurring? Okay, and this is something that's been something that I've been particularly interested in over the years, and I'm going to try and introduce this to you. Starting off locally. So in the universe today, very, very crudely, there are sort of two sorts of galaxies, okay? There are spiral galaxies that look like this, and then there are elliptical galaxies that look like this. These things are blue, and you'll remember blue means that there's some star formation going on, okay? These things are red, and because they're red, it means there aren't any blue stars, so there isn't much star formation going on, okay? So these things are red and dead, and these things are blue and star forming. So the things that we're seeing in the distant universe are forming lots of stars. So these stars formed at some point, right? So they're not forming now. So maybe these are the things that we're seeing in the distant universe, right? So we're seeing perhaps the formation of these things. So that would be, it'd be nice to be able to show that. It'd be nice to be able to show that what we've seen in the distant universe are actually these. But how do we go about that? We can't look at an individual object and watch it for 10 billion years, right? I probably wouldn't get enough research grants to cover that long. Okay? But it just so happens that in the universe today, the red ones, I apologize, I should probably be able to find a better slide than this, but the red objects tend to be found in clusters. It doesn't show up very well. Okay? The red objects are found in very dense regions, right? The red objects have friends. Okay? They have lots and lots of friends. The blue objects, on the other hand, you just find scattered around in the field. They don't have many friends. So we don't think that will have changed very much over the evolution of the universe. We don't think the positions of galaxies will have changed awfully. Okay? So if we can find things, if we can find that our star-forming galaxies in the distant universe have lots of friends, right, then it suggests that they are the progenitors, the things that formed these red galaxies today. Okay, so we took our map of the Hermes survey. This is now a much, much bigger map than I first showed you. So in this particular image, there are probably about 10,000 galaxies. And what we did is, in a statistical way, and I won't bother trying to explain how we do it, but we measure the pattern. We measure the pattern of these galaxies. Okay? And what we found was that the pattern that these galaxies have is exactly what we would have expected for for being the progenitors of these elliptical galaxies. And so we had a Nature paper which says, and I'm afraid this is a bit cryptic, but it said submillimeter galaxies, so that's these things, reside in dark matter halos, which means massive cluster things, with masses greater than 3 × 10^7 masses. So we'd basically measured the mass of these things, and we'd found that it was sufficient to be the progenitors of elliptical galaxies. Okay, so I've given you some understanding, I hope, of the star formation history of the universe, and I've tried to explain why that is important to you. And it's important because really the star formation history of the universe is the history of the production of chemical elements. Without this, there would be no life. The universe would be a very boring place indeed. And I hope I've explained to you that infrared astronomy is essential for our understanding of star formation. And hopefully I've given you some indication that over the last 3 decades, these infrared missions have dramatically transformed our understanding of the last 10 billion years of the universe. Okay, thank you very much.